Coming up on Boston Public Radio, almost all Syria all the time, a day after what the president calls a potential breakthrough, and 9 hours before President Obama addresses the nation. CNN's John King tells us where things stand. Then it's your turn. Anything the president can say tonight to move you, or are you putting all your eggs in the Kerry, Russia, surrender weapons basket? Then a break in the action. The mayoral candidates were debating everywhere last night. Adam Riley and Peter Kadzis tells us how they did.
The latest Democrat and the only woman yet to announce she's running for governor, Juliette Kayyem, joins us in studio. Then MSNBC's chief White House correspondent, Chuck Todd, on Obama and Kerry and Syria. And then a break. We'll end the show with all music, and it's going to be great. Stay tuned for all that on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Big day, Marjorie.
Big day.
All eyes and ears, obviously, are on Washington, and as President Obama prepares to make his speech about Syria tonight, about 9 hours from now. But the question is, could this allegedly accidental moment be the one that ends up resolving the Syrian crisis?
Is there anything at this point that his government could do or offer that would stop an attack?
Sure, he could turn over every single bit of his chemical weapons to the international community in the next week. Turn it over, all of it, without delay, and allow a full and total accounting for that. But he isn't about to do it, and it can't be done, obviously.
That was obviously Secretary of State John Kerry at a press conference yesterday in the U.K. Joining us on the line for the latest from the Capitol is CNN's chief national correspondent. He joins us every Tuesday at noon, John King. Hey, John.
Good day. So allegedly, what do you call it? Allegedly offhand proposal.
Allegedly accidental? Wasn't it?
Allegedly accidental. Look, it's really funny. After the secretary said that yesterday, Secretary Kerry, his own staff was saying it was a goof. It was a mess up. He was speaking rhetorically. That was not a serious proposal. And today, what they were calling at this time yesterday a joke is potentially their off-ramp from a military confrontation. It has been a remarkable 24 to 48 hours, and we haven't heard from the president yet, who's got a tough challenge tonight because he doesn't have the votes in Congress, and now he's hitting the pause button, and he's trying to tell the American people, I might need to use military force, but I want a little bit of time right now because I'm going to see if I can trust Vladimir Putin and Bashar al-Assad.
Well, it is difficult, but, you know, we were here in Massachusetts. We've been dubbing our former junior senator the accidental hero because, of course, as you said, yesterday it was a gaffe. Today it's the way out. But you do – that is the dilemma, John King. Trusting Putin, trusting you know, the president of Syria, Assad, is perilous at best.
It is. And if you score the administration minute by minute, they haven't had a good job. They haven't done a good job communicating here. There's been a lot of confusion and not much clarity to their strategy on something that clearly divides and troubles the country. And so you could say there's been a bit of Keystone Cops. However, if you score it by the day, you might have a slightly different approach. Even though it looks messy, yesterday the Assad government was denying it had chemical weapons. Today it says it's prepared to put them under international supervision and ultimately destroy them. You could argue that's progress. The question is, can you get from that declaration to actually doing that? And that's where people are conjuring up, you know, the old name Saddam Hussein, that we'll have a Security Council resolution. They'll try to send in weapons inspectors. Can you send in weapons inspectors right now? There's a civil war going on. How do you do that? Can you broker a ceasefire? The opposition doesn't like this plan. Can you inspect 30, 40, 50 suspected chemical weapons sites and put them under international supervision in the middle of a civil war? And then destroy them? That sounds kind of dicey at the best to me. And that's assuming everybody keeps their word, which is a huge assumption.
But I'm assuming, John, that there is coming out of Syria's agreement, allegedly again, to this morning, and the president saying it's a potential breakthrough in the speech tonight, I assume there's not going to be a straight up or down vote in Congress this week. If anything, there's going to be a vote to delay pending. What did he quote Reagan yesterday? Trusting and verifying that Assad is for real here. That's what's going to happen, isn't it?
Right. There will be no vote. Harry Reid was going to file the procedural stuff yesterday necessary to start the vote process today to get a final vote by the end of the week. That is on indefinite hold, in part because even John McCain says, I doubt it, I don't trust Putin, but you have to give any alleged, possible, maybe diplomatic opening, you have to give it a chance. You have to put it to the test. You can't say, no, we're going to launch cruise missiles on you, when Syria, at least with its words, says it's prepared to do something that if they did, it would be quite dramatic. So you do have to test this. And look, let's be honest, the president was short the vote. He would probably squeak it through in the Senate, although Ed Markey today said he would be a no vote under the current circumstances, John Kerry's replacement. But the president would probably squeak it through the Senate. There would not be a filibuster. He'd probably get 51, 52, maybe 53. The problem is he doesn't have the votes in the House. And so this allows the president to delay what would likely be a humiliation in the Congress. Maybe this works, or at least buys them a couple of months. If the United Nations Security Council passes the resolution, they try to put together some framework for inspections. Those inspectors go in. You're talking weeks and months to figure that part out. And then what happens, we don't know. If it all falls apart, the president's going to have to come back to Congress, and that will be his message tonight. If this falls apart, I'm going to ask the Congress to approve military strikes, and he's going to try to explain to a very, 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 and I could keep going with a very skeptical country, that this is a good idea.
So let's assume that it takes, what, I don't know, what would you say, just 45, 60 days, 90 days, whatever it is. Let's assume that's the interim resolution, hopefully the ultimate resolution. But during the time that the UN's doing what it's doing, inspectors are put in place, and as you say, logistically, how do they do this in the middle of civil war? Not with chemical weapons, but with traditional weapons, Assad continues to do what he did pre-chemical weapons. He adds to the 100,000 toll of dead Syrians. What do we do? What happens at the next press conference when somebody from CNN asked Barack Obama, so now we're just going to keep this process going while people continue to die in Syria? It seems to me that what wasn't a problem for him before this, meaning non-chemical attacks on Assad's own people, becomes a problem now that we're focused.
I think that's an excellent point to make, and that's why it's hard to see this working without a ceasefire. And the opposition says it opposes this, although the opposition, if push came to shove, because of the point you just made. You know, a few months ago, we were having conversations in this weekly chat about how the opposition was gaining ground. Now there is no question the dynamic has changed even before this horrendous use of chemical weapons. The dynamic had changed on the ground, and Assad was winning. And so let's assume, again, it's a huge hypothetical, but let's assume for the sake of the argument that Assad keeps his word regarding chemical weapons. You're absolutely right. If he's using his air force and he's using his artillery advantage to plow towns and to maim people, has the president not invested in that? Has he not bought that problem by backing away from military strikes here that, you know, they have finally come to acknowledge were going to be designed to degrade Assad's ability and to tilt the battlefield a little bit? It's a great question, and that's part of the dilemma. It's really hard to see this working absent a ceasefire. And it's really hard to see the parties at the moment agreeing to such a ceasefire. And then there's another question, which is, even if you get those two things, and I'm in fantasy land now, too many people would say I've gone way off the bridge saying Assad will keep his word about chemical weapons and there'll be a ceasefire, then you still have the problem that, are you leaving him in charge? And so does he Saddam Hussein this? Go along with the world until it stops paying attention and then go back to his old ways.
Well, that's the other question. Even if, you know, even right now, I mean, we can all remember back when we were over in Iraq looking for those chemical weapons that we never found. And remember, George Bush went to the press association dinner, was making a joke and saying, well, the chemical weapons must be under the couch or they must be underneath my chair somewhere. You get a replay of that as well. The whole world and certainly the American public saying, why should we believe this guy for a second when he says he has handed over all his weapons, no matter how many UN inspectors you have in there?
Well, they don't even believe their president when he says this is necessary, even though in our polling they do believe that Assad actually has them. With Saddam Hussein, they believed he had them. The American people, a clear majority, believe Assad has actually used them. So they believe he's a murderer. They believe he's a thug, that he's killing women and children. But they don't believe, and this is based on their experience. Look, think about the Iraq War. Think about Libya. Think about Egypt, which doesn't have a military dynamic, but think of all the things that we've either been promised or told in the Middle East. The United States is going to get involved, either militarily or diplomatically. It'll be limited. The price won't be too high, and then things are going to get better. Is Egypt better? Is Libya better? It was for a short time, then along came Benghazi. Egypt was for a short time, then along came this. And then if you go back to the Iraq War, the hangover of the Iraq War and the skepticism that the United States can do any good in this region is what's in front of the president. That he just cannot convince the American people that if it came to it, that you could have a limited military operation that would be successful, that would achieve the goals of the United States, and that would not lead to boots on the ground, a quagmire, or some huge embarrassment, or just, you know, extended commitment to the United States. The people just, look, they just won't believe him when he says it.
But, you know, I wonder tonight, John, even considering this new possibility with the Russians and the chemical weapons and the agreement and so forth, if what the president might do is appeal just to our patriotism and say, you know, we are America. We're the last best hope here. If we're not going to do anything, no one's going to do anything kind of deal. That's pretty a powerful argument for
it
some
is
of us anyway.
It is a powerful argument, and I think that's the argument he will make. Again, because this is the Middle East and because the track record, both long, if you look back a long time and if you look back in recent history, the track record of things, you know, touching this mess and turning it into, you know, not even gold, just copper or something, it's just not good. The track record in this region is just not good for anybody. So, I sound like I'm beating up the president a lot. Any president, Democrat, Republican, or, you know, independent would be having a hard time here. There are no good choices. And a lot of people say he's late to this cause, but here he is. And he's going to address the American people tonight. And I think that moral argument is his best argument. And he will look into the camera as a president, but also as a parent, and say, look around the room at your children. If this were happening to you, wouldn't you want, if there was somebody out there who could help, wouldn't you want them to help? If this was happening to you, wouldn't you want the world to step up and say, whoa, that's over the line? I say way over the line. I think that is the most powerful argument. And he's, you know, and that argument's quite effective. And even people who say no to the military operation acknowledge that part of it. The problem is, whenever you're making an argument in the times in which you live, in the times in which we live, you have a very polarized America anyway. And a lot of Republicans who would say yes if it were George W. Bush just won't say yes because it's Barack Obama. And beyond that, he has profound problems in his own party and among open-minded people, whether they're independents or Republicans, just because when they go back home, people are so skeptical and so tired of war and so tired of their, you know, their own son or daughter or their neighbor's son or daughter coming back either, you know, dead or with traumatic brain injuries and the cost of all this. The American people just, they don't want to listen to this, even though they get, that's the president's challenge, to break through on the moral argument to a country that just, even if in the back of its mind it says, oh God, he's right, just doesn't want to listen to him.
Hey, CNN's John King is the man with whom we are speaking. You've lived through, as a reporter, you've lived through a number of wars in the last couple of decades. And so I ask you this within the context of that experience. Does everything else shut down in Washington, assuming that we're all right and you're right, that there's this interim period, 45, 60, 90 days? Does immigration reform get locked into place? Does everything else get put on hold while everybody focuses on this international thing?
They have to do the spending stuff to keep the government running,
right,
and
I suspect
they will. Immigration reform, I think, has, you know, had a long pause button on it anyway. Let me say something about this debate. You know, we've talked a lot about, I call it, you know, the daycare center. I say it's like the fifth grade, and then, you know, you've heard me in the past say I call it the fifth grade, and I say the fifth graders in America are going to sue me for slander and have a pretty good case. We are having, you know, people listening have their own views on this. We've actually had a pretty healthy debate about this for the last week or so.
I agree. We're
having public hearings on this. The country is having a debate. You know, people are protesting. People are stating their positions, whether you're John McCain, you think the president's not tough enough, or you're Rand Paul and you think, you know, this is not the United States business. The president met with members of the Congressional Black Caucus yesterday. This is his base in the party. They tend to be anti-war. They tend to be more liberal. Most of them now are still undecided because they're torn between their loyalty to him and that moral cause Marjorie was just talking about and their passionate anti-war views. The country's having we could say it's late or whatever, but the debate has actually been, I think, mostly civil and mostly on the policy and on the legitimate questions about can we do this. Maybe they learn from that. Every time we have one of these actual healthy debates in a democracy, I pose the question, when we get to immigration, when we get to the debt ceiling, can they actually learn from this? And they usually prove me wrong and stupid and naive. But let's be hopeful. You know, okay. Dorchester breeds optimism.
Okay, we'll leave it with a glass half full for change. John, thanks so much for your time.
Long day ahead of you, John. It's going to be a historic day.
I heard you have Chuck Todd on the show. You know, since he's not a local, stump him with some big dick.
Okay. John King, thank you very much, as always. John King is the chief national correspondent for CNN. When we come back, we're going to be taking your calls on tonight's speech on what you think. think we should be doing in Syria? Should we trust the Russians? Should we trust Assad? 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. That conversation with you guys up next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. This is Jim Browdy. I am Jim Browdy. That was odd, wasn't it?
Okay. Talking about yourself with a third person,
know,
Jim. You know what that
on.
Means?
I know. Yeah, I do, but let's not tell anybody what it means. She is Marjorie. And now it's your turn, actually, as Marjorie said. Is there anything the president can say tonight that could move you if you are a no on a military strike against Syria? Or are you just putting all your eggs in the Kerry, Russia, surrender weapons basket? 877-301-8970. We'll get to your calls in a second. You can start lining up. I have to say, the irony, and maybe that's not the right word, the notion that this crisis could potentially be averted based upon an off-the-cuff throwaway by the Secretary of State. And for those who say, incidentally, it was intentional, if you listen to the sound before, a question was asked. He didn't offer this
affirmatively.
He was asked the question. He answered it saying, sure, there's a way to avoid this. And then he dismissed that way is ridiculous. What happened after that? Several hours later, Hillary Clinton goes to the White House, says, great idea. Russians glom onto it. Now, apparently, Assad has agreed to it. So we want to know what you think. And is there anything? These numbers this morning, the CBS New York Times poll, by a little more than a 2-1 margin, people still oppose a military strike, which is consistent with what it's been. And the needle has not moved at all in the direction of John Kerry and Barack Obama's position. If anything, Marjorie, it's moved in the opposite direction.
Listen, I think it would be great if our former United States Senator John Kerry is seen, as I said before, the accidental hero that gets us out of this mess, because it's not been an easy week for John Kerry. He's been way out in the plank talking about the horrors in Syria, talking about the slaughters there. Meanwhile, he's getting ridiculed on these websites about his face looking puffy and all this kind of stuff.
By the way, people who think that's a cheat, the Washington Post did a piece yesterday.
Yes, they did.
On the state of his face. So this is not just a low rent, like New York Post kind of thing.
Are you accusing me of being low rent?
No, I'm not at all. I love this, and I love low rent too. 877-301-8970, but maybe not on a day like this. Let's start in Dedham with Sean. Sean, you're on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Sean.
Jim and Marjorie, how are you today?
We're thrilled to be hearing from you, Sean.
I know you would be, Jim. Marjorie, how are you, sweetie?
I'm excellent, Sean. Thanks for calling.
I saw you on news. I saw you somewhere the other day. You look fabulous, by the way. You're looking great.
Thank you.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It, Sean. What's
Marjorie.
Up?
Yes.
Marjorie.
What's going on?
To you, not to the tall one.
Okay.
In his opening paragraph tonight, Jimmy, does he plan on saying that he plans on handing back the Nobel Peace Prize and just asking where he should mail it to? Or
he being the president of the United States?
That would be he, yes.
Sean, where are you? I mean, I know you're not a huge fan of the presidents, but prior to this potential breakthrough, as Barack Obama called it last night, where were you on a military strike against Syria?
I think that we are stretched to the gills. We have needs in our own country. Look at all the people on EBT. We obviously have needs in our own country, Jimmy. Let's address those first. Let's let those people over there deal with their own thing for once. Let's the United States for once. Let's not get in the way of someone. Granted, people are dying, and it's horrible. But let's for once let these people try to figure it out on their own.
I think, Sean, you are where the vast majority of American people are. Sean, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. 8.5 hours till the president speaks to the nation about we don't know exactly what he's going to speak about. We assume, as John King just said to us, it's going to be, there may be a breakthrough. Let's give it some time. After which, if they're messing around, then we're going full bore.
Yeah, he's still got to convince us, obviously, because this is very tenuous at best at the moment, I would say. Eddie from Hingham, what do you think about Syria, Eddie?
I don't think the president has to convince us at all tonight. What he's going to say, if you vote it down, fine, it's your baby. If this stuff gets loose with Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah and goes through the Middle East and Europe and ends up here in the United States, you go to a football game or a baseball game, or somebody puts it in a school duck and kills 3,000 students, it's on Congress, not him. He told them what to do.
Yeah, but Eddie, last week when the Secretary of State John Kerry was saying, I think it was a week ago Saturday, that our national security interests are at stake. That came 4 days after the president in Sweden said the exact opposite, that he couldn't make the case that there was a direct and an imminent threat to our national security. But Eddie, thanks for the call. I think what he's going to say tonight is that without this threat of a military strike, there would never have been Russia's proposal, which Syria theoretically has acceded to. And if we withdraw this threat, then the possibility of a negotiated solution and surrender of chemical weapons disappears, which makes his case a little bit stronger.
You know what is so surreal about this? Here are the Syrians back there waiting to find out what's going to happen. You see these pictures of people flooding over the border, the refugees going into Turkey and stuff. And is the United States going to hit us? Is the United States not going to hit us? They're going to hit the right spaces. I mean, you know, what do I do with my kids? Do I go to Turkey too? Do I stay here? I mean, I just can't imagine. In addition to the civil war, this
2 million refugees so far, 2 million. And if you've seen any of the video on the stations or actually heard reports here on WGBH, the conditions in these camps are just, it's like unthinkable. Let's go to a cell phone where Paul is on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thanks for the call, Paul.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
First of all,
I did see you. Hi, how are you? Great. I did see you on MSNBC this morning.
Yeah.
Marjorie, you look marvelous.
And?
I mean, not bad either.
Thank you, Paul.
I'll take that as a compliment,
Paul.
Thank
you. They did a nice job in the makeup.
Well, I'm not sure it was just makeup, Marjorie. Give yourself a little more credit than that. It, you know, it makes me wonder whether the MSNBC shouldn't be live simulcasting this program. On their program.
Send him a note, will you, and let us know how it goes.
Yeah, text him, text him.
Okay, what do you think? Let's get back to Syria for a minute, but thanks.
On this, I'm wondering whether it's almost a twist on the Cuban Missile Crisis solution. History isn't quite repeating itself, but as I remember, Kennedy got two communiques from Khrushchev, I believe at the time, one more aggressive than the other one, one seeming to have a solution, and Kennedy ignored the more aggressive one, and it ended up that the Russians would take the missiles out of Cuba. And here again, it seems like we have the Russians stepping in, not the Soviet Union, with a communique which seems to solve the problem. We hope that it will, but I just think it was an odd twist that their communiques would now seem to be coming in, maybe backroom communications with. And I think in time, the history will prove that there were behind-the-scenes negotiations with Putin. And I forgot the other ambassador's name that Kerry met with.
The French ambassador.
Well, let me tell you, if that's a poll, that would be very comforting to me, because while I hope there's a negotiated resolution here without a military strike, I would prefer that it not be as accidental as we are being led to believe. If, in fact, there have been back channels and this was just the public exposure of those back channels, I think that'd be a terrific outcome. Paul, thanks for the call. Let's go to Worcester, where Muhammad is on Boston Public Radio. Muhammad, thanks for the call.
Yes, hi. How are you, Jim?
Excellent. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. You know what? I think no matter what Barack Obama said tonight, I don't think he's going to convince me. You know why?
Why?
Because I don't think he's himself convinced about the chemical weapon attacks, because he knows he's going to add al-Qaeda. He's going to help the radical Muslim in the Middle East by attacking Syrian government. You know why? One more thing I'm going to say.
Well, let me be clear. Muhammad, before you say the additional thing, you're not saying the president doesn't believe Assad used chemical weapons on his own people.
You're saying that the
Obama solution, he doesn't even believe in. Is that where you're going?
Exactly.
Okay.
Because we need Ted Kennedy. We need someone to stand up to Obama to say, stop it. John Kerry, he was one of my heroes, but now he lost me. Barack Obama, I voted twice for him, but now no way I'm going to vote Democrat. I am liberal Democrat. But you know what? I am very disappointed to see Barack Obama and John Kerry pushing for wars like that. We should fight, like what I said, a peaceful solution.
Muhammad, thank you for the call. I think you're where the vast majority of the American people are. Whether your war weariness is because of what Colin Powell said years ago, because of the messaging here, that is the overwhelming, not just predominant feeling of most Americans. 877-301-8970. Again, by the way, we should mention the president's address tonight at 9 o'clock will be broadcast live and carried here on WGBH radio again on, at 9 o'clock right here on 89.7.
I'm stating the obvious here, but there are two great arguments on either side. I mean, there really are two great arguments. The moral argument on the side of the United States stepping in because of the chemical weapons, and we have agreed since World War I that we're not going to use these, and it is kind of ridiculous in some ways to think, or ironic, I suppose, to talk about making rules about how you conduct wars, but that's what we've essentially
done. I understand
that
intellectually, but I have to say, you and I have had this discussion on the air and off the air before. The absurdity. I understand the history. I understand the argument. I probably agree with it, as I say, intellectually. The absurdity that he could draw down his chemical weapons and we'd be satisfied, and then the next day start slaughtering his people yet again with non-chemical weapons is almost Saturday Night Live-esque.
Well, no, there's a difference, though, in my mind anyway, and the difference is that there's no target. There's no way to aim the chemical weapons,
that.
So you take out entire—
They're not discriminating.
Exactly.
You said that a week ago. You're right.
And I think that, that's a big difference.
What's the other argument? In favor
of it?
You said there are two arguments in favor.
That, you know, it's like Bill Clinton said about Rwanda and like he eventually said about Bosnia and went in there, that there is a moral question here. And the French are sort of with us, I guess, in their half-baked kind of way. Nobody else is. That the United States is still the policeman of the world and that that we're going to go in there and say, enough. We're not going to put up with this.
Should we go into Egypt and resolve that whole dispute?
Well,
post-Morsi?
No. Well, I don't think we're talking about going in and taking out chemical weapon sites in Egypt, are we?
Oh, you mean policemen of the world because of the chemical weapon issue.
In this one instance. I mean, that's not convincing most of Americans, but that is the argument, and we'll see if Barack Obama makes it effectively tonight, the great communicator. Let's go to Fred from New Hampshire. Hi, Fred.
Hi. Great show. Listen to you every day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I voted for Barack Obama twice, and I've been trying to ponder why he's been taking this Bush-like run-up to war. And I think it's one, he's a parent, and seeing unvarnished videos of kids being gassed has got him, which is understandable. Two, is never mentioned in the media, unfortunately, hardly, is, and I'm not anti-Jewish, I am anti-right-wing Israel government, the IPAC is in full gear, the pro-Israel lobby.
IPAC,
that is an equation.
And so the end of the sentence, what is the end of the thought, and where do you go with that? I mean, they have been lobbying for,
understandably,
in favor of the president.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is not in our interest, and IPAC in Israel has not been in our political interest for some time, and it's never mentioned, and it is a huge factor here.
Yeah, but so is the premise upon which you're basing this call that we are they bark, and or what's that expression? They clap, and we say jump, they say jump, and we say how high? Is that where you're going with this, that they are essentially guiding us in this thing?
Policy, I mean, it's ridiculous.
And I have to say, Fred, with all due respect, in this instance, I disagree with you. I am talk about an accidental hero, potentially, in John Kerry. I think we're in an accidental situation where had the president not made the red line comment when he made it, we would just be blithely going by as Assad does what Assad does. So maybe in other circumstances, AIPAC has a more powerful role. I'm not sure that it does here. But thank you. We appreciate your call, Fred.
Or it could just be that, like a lot of other people, they say one thing when they're running for office and they're very opposed to all these strong arm measures and they're very opposed to the Patriot Act, et cetera, et cetera. And then they get into office, they become the president of the United States, they get those security briefings every morning and they see things differently. I mean, Barack Obama would certainly not be the first president to run one way and end up going someplace else once he actually gets in office. Raphael from Providence. What do you think, Raphael?
Hi, I think, first of all, I'm going to say hi to you guys.
Hi
to you, Rafael. Hi.
I think the president is facing a double-edged sword here. On one hand, he wants to keep Syria, Iran, and all these other countries, you know, from following up, from not doing these horrible things they're doing. But at the same time, there's all this pressure from home. I don't think the president wants to go into war, like the earlier caller said. He doesn't really believe in the war himself. That's probably why he has a hard time selling it. But at the same time, he feels like he really needs to send a message, which is really, really putting him in a difficult situation.
Listen, I mean, that's a good theory. You know, I don't know. You hate to think, as Jim just said, that this is all about Barack Obama having announced that if the Syrians cross the red line, he's going to do something. But
I think
you're
right.
By the way,
there have been some deeply respected analysts who I've heard on television, both from the right and the left, saying that is why he's got to go ahead here. Even if you disagree with the proposal, the argument goes, and even if you think the outcome would be totally counterproductive, you can't have the president of the United States issuing an ultimatum and then not following up on it. I'm not defending that position, but that is people have vocalized that, not the president himself, I guess, but others have. Rafael, thank you so much for the call.
But he's changed on so many fronts. Who would have thought Barack Obama would be the person deporting more illegal?
Yeah, but can I tell you, Marjorie, there's war and there's everything else as far as I'm concerned. You can dance on health care. I don't mean about anybody. You can dance on health care. You can dance on budgets. You can dance on anything you want. The one place that stays with,
he has
with
danced.
You your whole – no,
he's
but stays
on
with
Iraq
you forever.
He's danced on Afghanistan.
Yeah, but ultimately he ran, and you've said it repeatedly – probably the major reason he beat Hillary Clinton in the primaries is because of his opposition to Iraq and her support of the Iraq war resolution. He has, for the most part, gotten us out of Iraq. He's in the midst of withdrawing at least combat forces from Afghanistan. Obviously, this runs counter to those kinds of things.
How many times have you said, why are we still there going into 2014? Why are
into
we in
Afghanistan?
Yes.
Yeah, but it's not at the pace that I would like it to be, nor is it the pace of the American people. In fact, you know, people supported the war in Afghanistan at the beginning. The most recent poll I've seen, close to 2/3 of Americans say the war was not worth fighting. If you're the mother or father or wife or husband or child of one of the men or women who lost their lives in Afghanistan in furtherance of the United States policy,
exactly.
And you hear the American people don't just want us out now, but think it wasn't worth fighting to begin with. I mean, how do you feel?
The libertarian Senator Rand Paul had one of the best lines in this whole mess.
Yeah,
when he was taking Senator John Kerry to task, or former Senator, I should say, now Secretary of State John Kerry to task, because, of course, Kerry first vaulted onto the national stage when he said, how can you be the last man to die from a mistake, referring, of course, to Vietnam, when he was a big anti-war guy. And Rand Paul had this great line, how can you ask a man to be the first man to die for a mistake? I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what he said, and it was a great point by Rand Paul.
Let's take one more.
Alan from Cambridge. Hi, Alan.
Hi, how do you do? First-time caller.
I just
wanted to point out to Jim Browdy that the Economist in August suggested that before the first missiles are fired, Mr. Obama must give Mr. Assad one last chance, a clear ultimatum to hand over his chemical weapons entirely within a very short period. The time for inspections is over, says the Economist. If Mr. Assad gives in, then both he and his opponents will be deprived of such poisons, a victory for Mr. Obama. If Mr. Assad refuses, he should be shown as little mercy as he has shown to the people he claims to govern.
Well, if President Obama and John Kerry had read The Economist in August, we could have saved ourselves a lot of pain in the last...
Well, maybe they did.
Maybe they did.
The result. So it might not be so accidental as you are suggesting.
And by the way, the basis for my conclusion that it's accidental, frankly, is not just watching the video and playing the audio as we did with John King a few minutes ago. John Kerry's own staff and the Secretary of State and the State Department said after that press conference in the UK yesterday that he had not intended to make those remarks. They originally were trying to distance themselves from it until they realized it was gaining some traction. But Alan, thank you for the... for the update on what The Economist had to say.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to go over the Boston mayor's race with a focus on what we learned from the candidates last night in various debates and forums that happened across the city. One happened right here at WGBH. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH for that conversation.
Can we reinvent learning when academia is a field steeped in tradition?
The accountability movement is sweeping the nation, and I'm very glad that it has come to Massachusetts.
Under the new plan, MassBay will see a 16% spike in state funding next year.
Listen for reports from WGBH's Higher Education Desk on campus with reporter Kirk Carapeza on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Dover Rug and Home. Rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's new showroom in Natick or at doverrug.com. And the Greater Boston Theater Expo at the BCA on Tuesday, September 10th. Learn about the upcoming seasons at more than 55 local theater companies, including special ticket offers. More info at stagesource.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie. And we will return to the Syria discussion later in the show. But last night, there were three opportunities to meet the mayoral candidates. Emily Rooney hosted part of one of her 4-hour-long mayoral forums last night. There'll be another one tonight, Wednesday and Thursday, 3 candidates per night. The Boston Herald and NECN collaborated with Suffolk University on a 12-candidate debate. 9 of the 12 mayoral hopefuls attended a forum on the arts. By the way, that one we'll talk to Jared Bowen about on Thursday of this week. Here with us in Studio 3 to go over what we might have learned last night, maybe what we didn't, are from WGBH, Adam Riley and Peter Katz. Hey, gentlemen.
Howdy, guys.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. So, who woke up the happiest this morning of all these candidates?
Well, it depends on how you define happy. Now, Margie,
who are you, Bill Clinton?
Yeah, as you said, the front runners are still front runners.
Yeah.
If you're not happy with the status quo in Boston, I would say those voters, the voters who like John Conley or Bill Walczak, woke up happy. If you don't like the front runners in Boston, then I would say Consalvo supporters and supporters of John Barrows woke up happy.
Why? Wait, before you go to Adam, so why you say if you're not a huge Meninoophile, even though in polls most people suggest they are, why Walczak and Connolly? Connolly on education, Walczak on casinos?
Well, not just that. Conley said the police, both were more critical, and to some degree, Marty Walsh, too, of current administration conduct. And that was just refreshing.
Yes.
I mean, it was just refreshing.
How about you, Adam Riley?
Peter's answer made me feel like I was listening to an LSAT question being read aloud. I feel like there's some sort of logic game going on that I can't quite grasp. So I'm going to give the simple person's answer. I'm going to say that Marty Walsh woke up happiest because he is, by all accounts, one of the two front runners, maybe the front runner. And I felt like no one laid a glove on him last night, really.
They didn't.
You know, Joe Battenfeld tried to push him on the issue of, you know, you're such a union guy. Could you really negotiate in a tough way with unions?
And by the way, Marty Walsh had a prepared, really cute answer when he said something like, he said, I'm really surprised. I didn't expect a question about unions, which is a perfect way to sort of defuse
he
it before
it.
He answered.
He made it a laugh line. Everyone chuckled at it. And then he offered 3 examples. You know, I thought they were pretty effective examples to make the case that he could, in fact, be tough on unions when it was appropriate. But again, it's almost less about what Marty Walsh did and more about what the other candidates didn't do. I mean, it seems to me like everyone, with the possible exception of John Connolly, had reason to go after him really aggressively yesterday. And in the Herald-Suffolk debate, Neckin debate, I didn't see it. You know, people didn't seem to want to or know how to try to tear him down. So I think it was a really good night for him simply for that reason.
You know, by the way, if you didn't hear last night or happened not to watch Emily, just to give you a feel of some of the candidates, here's a little bit of a montage on casinos. First, you'll hear John Conley, then Dan Conley, then Charlotte Guller-Ritchie, and then Bill Walczak, the candidate who's been most anti-casino in the crowd.
We're going to live with whatever this casino brings in a way no one else in Boston will. So please let our neighborhood decide something that's going to so disproportionately impact us.
Where are we going as a city? It's going to affect our character, our culture, and it needs a citywide vote.
If the people of East Boston did not want a casino and the entire city voted for a casino, would we actually ram that casino down their throats?
My view is it's a public health disaster. What we need to do is we need to stop casinos. This is becoming a national debate now because casinos are happening all across the country, and Boston should not have a casino.
By the way, the first 3 comments, Conley, and Guller-Ritchie were responding to questions about should it just be the people in East Boston who get the vote, which apparently is what it's going to be, as opposed to citywide. Is that, you know, I've said this to Adam Riley the other day, Peter Katzis. I've gotten both your names wrong in the last 2 minutes. I'll do better. It's like
okay,
I'm in the
Jim.
Debate.
Make it more like me.
Peter, is the casino thing gaining as much traction as I thought? I didn't think it was a majority thing. I didn't think it'd be necessarily a winner in a final. I assumed in a field of 12 that Walczak would get huge traction on this thing. Is he?
He's getting some traction. I wouldn't say huge. You know, the casino's a sort of black and white issue. Frankly, even though I agree with what Dan Conley said, I thought John Conley articulated it the best. My own view of it is somewhat cynical. It's coming anyway. I'd rather have it in Boston than in Everett.
Somebody said that to Walczak last night, did they not? I can't remember which candidate it was. One of them said, this is done. This is no longer...
You know, Rob Consalvo kept saying, you can't stop a casino, but I felt like his language... Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I mean, Peter's right. It's Everett is going to have it if Boston doesn't, but there's going to be a referendum. That's the point of this debate over the citywide versus East Boston thing. So I was actually surprised that no one called, can I say BS on the air? Called BS on Rob Consalvo and said... Rob, what are you talking about? You know, we're discussing here who gets a chance to say whether we're going to have a casino in Boston or not. Don't keep saying it's a done deal when it isn't.
No, but Walczak isn't making the connection. He's not making the point that there's going to be a referendum, a statewide referendum to reconsider.
By
the way, there's not going to be a statewide referendum. Just to update that, one of the questions that Martha Coakley disqualified is violative of the Constitution. Now, they may go to court and put it back on the ballot. Was the whole casino repeal thing.
And I
didn't realize.
Wondered,
yeah, just
good
in the last
point.
Couple of
Thank
days.
Thank you, Jim.
I've
sure.
actually wondered if that might be a boost to people like Walczak and Dan Conley, who were striking an anti-casino note in the mayor's race, because I had the impression before that a lot of the anti-casino activists like Celeste Myers from East Boston, other people involved in No Easy Casino, that they were really putting their hopes in, you know, overturning it statewide. And I wonder now, and I think it's still an open question, if that might provide a bit of a boost at the ballot box in the prelim, maybe even in the final, to whichever candidates are able to channel that anti-casino sentiment.
I wanted to insert two things here. Number one, I thought Walczak, who many people like a lot, very smart guy, built up the Codman Square Health Center and stuff, looked slightly ticked off the entire time during the debate last night on NACN, the Herald's debate. Let's hope he does better. It looks more congenial when he's on with them.
He's over with Emily tonight, by the way. He's part of the trio tonight.
Emily, second, Charles Clemens, and Charles Yancey.
The second thing is, I know you guys don't think much of my theory at all, but nonetheless, I'm going to put it forward. That Charlotte Goler-Ritchie, who's been criticized for having a lackluster no-message campaign, I thought positioned herself last night as the candidate for African-Americans, people of color. She kept, when we were talking about the casino and people were saying it's disaster, she jumped right in and said disaster in Boston is guns and
well, here it is. Let's hear her. Here is first, here's Bill Walczak, again on the casino thing, segue into crime, and then Goler-Ritchie.
My view is it's a public health disaster. What we need to do is we need to stop casinos. This is becoming a national debate now because casinos are happening all across the country, and Boston should not have a casino. If elected, I will stop the casino.
Mr. Conley, you've been very public health disaster. A disaster is guns on the streets in certain neighborhoods. That's a disaster. That's a crisis, and that's something that we need to step up and address. And if a casino, in fact, comes to the city of Boston, I would want to take some of that revenue. We're expecting somewhere between $32 million to $50 million in revenue annually. And I would want to take some of that and put it towards crime prevention measures.
Half the candidates here are African-American or as Latino, half are white. I thought, and there's been talk about, of course, her people trying to squeeze everybody else out.
Kevin
so everybody
Peterson,
can,
her former campaign manager, now the head of the
herself, but I thought that was a smart move for her, saying, I am the person with the ear of the neighborhoods of Mattapan, Roxbury, and Dorchester that are in the sea of crime. She talked about a tale of two cities. I thought she was better than I've seen her before.
She was excellent on that issue. I mean, she was terrific. And maybe because I'm disappointed that she hasn't caught more fire before, that I'm not as enthusiastic as I should be. She was good. There's no question about it. Walczak is the candidate of the goo-goos. You know?
Let me just jump in and be the Debbie Downer here where it comes to Charlotte Goler-Ritchie.
I
didn't actually think she was good on that issue. I felt like what I was listening to there was a woman who is a yes woman for Tom Menino and who's going to, you know, spin the casino positively in exactly the way Mayor Menino would. I thought that was kind of a weak answer myself. And I also don't think... I didn't feel watching the debate like she positioned herself as sort of the de facto candidate for voters of color or voters who would like to see a candidate of color elected. I thought, actually, not to get ahead of ourselves, I thought John Barros was excellent last night.
He was terrific.
He was really good. I even thought I've interviewed Charles Clemens before and not been impressed by him. I thought Clemens was actually really good last night, and Charles Yancey was pretty good, too. So I don't feel like if you're a candidate, if you're a voter who's especially interested
Charles
in a non-white
Yancey?
Candidate.
Yeah,
Yancey was pretty good.
Hey,
and just one other thing, and then I'll pipe down. Listen. I just want to make a point that I think that the reason that Bill Walczak looked grumpy for part of the evening is because Dan Conley very effectively took the anti-casino mantle from him and articulated the anti-casino argument in, I thought, a more eloquent and forceful way. So maybe he's bummed out that he's losing his pet issue.
I agree with that about Dan Conley. And as a resident of Boston, I want to know why I don't get a vote. But let's go back to Charles Yancey for a second. Look, Yancey is an old-fashioned politician. You know, he begins every... I'm Charles Yancey. I'm running for mayor of Boston.
That's right. Also running for city council.
Don't underestimate his appeal to his core constituents. He's playing a very different game from everyone else. He's not running for mayor of Boston. He says he is. He's running to get as many votes as he can so he can trade something with whoever becomes mayor.
Oh, that's
you
know,
you both
point.
Were speaking, praising, at least you were, Adam Riley, Dan Connolly, the DA, not John Connolly, the former teacher and city councilor. But the tough moment, I think, for Connolly last night, at least depending on which group of voters you're talking about, is when he started talking about reducing how shootings were down and how crime was down. And was it Barros that responded to that? I can't remember. I think it was Charles Clemens. Was it Clemens?
Really went after,
but essentially, the point that was made is, well, maybe your overall statistics suggest that crime is down, but crime is not down in Dorchester, Roxbury, and Mattapan. So the first half may comfort people who are not living in those communities. The second half may be a total turnoff, and maybe that's not something he's concerned about, to people who've experienced practically a shooting a day since the marathon.
I totally agree with you that was a really rough patch for him. And if he makes it into the final, it's something that could be leveraged against him. No argument for me there.
You know, one of the things that I'm hoping, I haven't seen that. I hope Emily got a good audience last night and we'll have a good audience Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. I hope my television station has a good audience. I continue to worry, Marjorie and I discuss this every day, that there, 14 days to go till the runoff when 12 become 2. And unless you were with somebody last night and felt good because he or she lived up to your expectations or maybe a little more, or maybe a little disappointed because somebody, you'd think Michael Ross didn't do spectacularly well last night, even though he was great on Emily.
It was interesting. He was great with Emily, yeah. Talking about the innovation stuff, talking about the new Boston. He didn't get very fiery in the Herald debate.
I guess so my question is, does it make it, I mean, what is going to, is it last night and the coverage, radio, newspapers this morning, that's going to begin to separate this pack? Or are we going to continue to have a leader at 12%, which is really not a leader because it's within the margin of error of almost being last in these polls? What's going to separate the pack, Adam Riley?
My hunch, my non-quantitative, probably totally incorrect hunch, is that in the prelim, when the votes are counted, that they are all actually going to be grouped pretty closely together. I mean, you've got some of the candidates, Peter and I have talked about this, some of the candidates spending a lot more on ad money than others. Mike Ross, for example, has spent a lot of money on what I think is the best mayoral ad of the bunch. Then you've got the people who are spending money to, you know, hire staffers to get out the vote on, you know, on election day, the days right before the election. I got to ask you why you're chuckling.
I'm laughing only because when you were with us about a week ago, we were going through the ads, you and I were both saying, I don't know if you were here this day, Marjorie, how much we like the Michael Ross running through the streets of Boston. That night, former WGBH employee John Carroll was on my television show, and I said, I love that commercial. And John turned to me on the air, and he says, do you really want to hire the paper boy as your next?
No, that's actually David James Wyatt.
He thought that Michael Ross looked quite young.
The thing that's telling, the number that's telling in this race is, until the new Globe poll comes out, which is expected any day now, the last poll showed 40% of the people undecided.
Yeah.
That is unbelievably high. To me, that says a lot of people won't vote. Normally, at this time in the race, you've got maybe 15% undecided, maybe 20. You know, that's double the number.
But what do you say? Again, it gets back to the separation thing. Felix Arroyo, about 42 times last night on the NECN Herald debate, tried to say, I have this path out of poverty thing, and he got cut off mid-sentence by either my colleague, Allison King,
and he talks so or Joe fast, Batten. Too.
Well, he's talking so fast because he was trying to get a whole sentence out, because it's very hard to moderate.
He didn't get cut off when he spoke in Spanish, though.
12 people.
But
how do you make the case to the? I assume the 40% are the people who are least engaged, but I assume they're likely voters. I'm guessing. I don't remember.
That's of likely voters.
Okay, so other than maybe on a television ad, how do you distinguish, or other than in a position dramatically different from almost everybody else, like the casino thing, for example, what do you say to separate yourself? I care about poor people. I care about crime in the streets. I have a better plan to create real jobs in Boston. What is the thing that sticks with that, any piece of that 40%, Peter Kadzis?
Schools. I think schools are going to be what drives this election.
Is that John Connolly's
issue? That's John Connolly. At the moment, I would say that Marty Walsh has more momentum, but I think a number of those undecided voters will ultimately coalesce around John Conley and, because the apparents.
And the district attorney, Dan Conley, had to explain why his kids were not in the public schools. I thought it gave a pretty good reason.
I thought
it was religious education. That was what his focus was.
I've actually
was.
Wondered if that exchange might work to his benefit ultimately because I think, you know, it was interesting to watch some of the other candidates come to his defense. I think John Connolly was one of the first people in to say, Joe Battenfeld, I don't think that was a fair question to ask Dan Connolly. So, you know, if you were a voter who happened to be watching, if you catch wind of this, if you're someone who, say, is educating your kids at a Catholic school, you might, you know, maybe that'll create a solidarity vote.
Catholic school parents vote, too.
You know? That's right. That's right.
Is there anybody who was considered a potential finalist, meaning making it to the top two on September 24th. Is there anybody who disqualified themselves last night? Remember, the first half of my question was who is considered a player in this, who, because of their performance on Emily's show or the Emerson Arts debate or the and again, we'll discuss that with Jared Bowen on Thursday, or with the NECN Herald Suffolk debate. Was anybody who just got themselves out of the mix?
No, I didn't see that. I mean, I think I would agree that it was a missed opportunity for Mike Ross because I felt like he had some momentum hooked to that ad. Again, he was terrific on Emily's show. I think he's really good talking about big picture policy issues. And in the debate, in the Neck and Herald debate, he didn't manage to convey that sort of image
passion.
Of the vigorous, passionate, youthful guy that he's conveyed effectively in a lot of other formats. But that's not disqualifying.
Let me answer the flip side of your question. I think the person who might have edged closer to the top was Consalvo. Consalvo, throughout the night, was as close as you could be running for local office to a statesman. He had a steady tone of voice. Whether you agreed with him or not on particular issues, he was clearly thoughtful. I thought, on the whole, it was a good night for Consalvo.
Well, you know, in all fairness, we try to embrace fairness here as often as we possibly can. One candidate we haven't mentioned at all, we should at least give 30 seconds to. Can we give – there was a candidate, at least in the NECN debate, who didn't say anything until he was asked the question right before the end of the first hour of the debate. I don't. His name is Wyatt. Here he is.
Mayor Menino, as you know, refused to let Chick-fil-A open a store in Boston because of its president's stance on gay issues and gay marriage. Should a business be denied the opportunity to open here based on ideology? Would you have let that store open here?
I would have allowed the store to open, but only because I share the views of the owner of Chick-fil-A.
That's the only reason. So you think ideology is a fair test?
Also, I think that just to be equal and to be democratic, I would not hold someone's ideas, their beliefs against them in allowing them to have a business in the city.
Yeah, I don't want to criticize any of the moderators. Because
he should have said they make a hell of a chicken sandwich.
Can I tell you something? I love Emily Rooney. I work with Allison King, big fan of hers. Joe Battenfeld filled in for me on NECN. The fact that all three chose to wake him up in the middle of those debates is just is totally...
To me, he wasted his time and he wasted the time of the viewers and he had no business being there. Defend him, Peter Cassis. You said you were going to.
No, I wasn't going to. I feel sorry for him. I think
sorry
he should
for him? What's he doing there?
He should have been allowed to be mute on the stage. No one should have asked him anything.
Well, I think he forced himself into the consciousness of all the people that were watching the debates with what criteria?
Assume, the weird thing is you assume he had a message that he wanted to get out there since he went to the trouble to get the signatures necessary to be on the ballot. And then, you know, I was watching him on Greater Boston yesterday, and he had the exact same body language that he had on the Neck and Herald debate.
Leaning back with his hands in his lap.
Leaning back, looking off into space,
like
not
look.
Looking at the people who are talking, just looking like he would rather be anywhere else in the world but there. So I don't really know what he's doing. Another interesting point I want to bring to everyone's attention about David James Wyatt, his beard is slowly becoming two beards. It's kind of split
Adam
in the middle.
Adam is big on this. Adam is big on this.
And
detail,
if
man,
you take
Adam.
A look, next time you see him, you won't be able to look away.
Thank you for that contribution. I think it's – so there are only 2 weeks to go. We'll be talking a lot about the mayoral race in those 14. It is amazing. It's going to be down to two.
I know. I'm getting excited.
In just 14 days. Peter and Adam, thanks so much as always.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. We have been speaking with Adam Riley and Peter Cassis, both of WGBH. When we come back, we're going to continue our election coverage with Juliet Kayyem. She tossed her hat into the governor's race last month. Only woman running so far. She's going to tell us what she would do for Massachusetts up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Thank you.
12 candidates are running for mayor of Boston. Who are they and what are their plans for the city? I'm Emily Rooney. All this week we meet the Boston mayoral candidates, three candidates over four nights. We'll get their take on the city's most pressing issues. Join us for a special Greater Boston tonight on WGBH2 and right here on 89.7 WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Museum of Science, where you can uncover a portal to ancient times at the new Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. See what life was really like over 2,000 years ago. More information at mos.org. And Metro Rock Climbing Centers in Everett, Newburyport, and opening soon in Burlington, Vermont. You can see the beauty of fall in New England from a whole new viewpoint with their outdoor classes and guiding services. MetroRock.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Normally at this time on Tuesdays, we'd have open mic with Charlie Baker. But now that he's entered the governor's race on the Republican side, we've decided to turn the mic for the next handful of weeks over to all the Democratic candidates running in the race. Here with us in Studio 3 is Juliette Kayyem. She's a former columnist of the Boston Globe, lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She spent nearly 15 years in counterterrorism, homeland security, and emergency management. Juliette, it's great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Juliette, before we get to Massachusetts, yes. I'm dying to ask you, because you are an expert of homeland security and you know a lot about security. And we've been talking about Syria all day. Is it even possible that if everything goes well and the Russians go in and we have these UN inspectors looking for these chemical weapons and stuff, is it possible to actually verify that they're gone, or is this just like a rock part two?
Oh, I think it's absolutely possible. I mean, I think this issue is relevant to a governor's race. I think it's important to the citizens of the state. We have a National Guard and a military used to oversee them. We have a Syrian population. People are interested. I think it's a fair question. I have to tell you, I think this may be a bit of a gift from Russia, and we should let it play out. I don't see why we would be in a hurry. I see an importance of verifying what they're doing, but we shouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth right now. This may be an out for everyone, and that would be good. And meanwhile, no more chemical weapons will be used by Syria. The long-term strategy, no one should pretend like this is a long-term strategy with what's happening in Syria. I was just there when I was with the Globe. I was on the Jordanian-Syrian border. The refugee crisis will be with us a long time, and it's relevant to Israel, Lebanon, Jordan, and our allies.
You know, speaking of weapons, this is an awful segue, but we all saw you nonstop on CNN after April 15th with this horror at the marathon. The New York Times over the weekend did a story about something we've talked a lot about on the air since April 15th, this one Boston thing, the notion that there is one Boston for the people who died or were horribly injured on Boylston Street, and there's another Boston for those who live in Dorchester, Roxbury, and Mattapan. Where are you in that issue, Juliette?
Do you mean in terms of the...
In terms of response to crime, attention to violence, and what some people in Dorchester, Roxbury, and Mattapan see as terrorism in their backyard.
Right, exactly. No, and I think that's right. I mean, I think one Boston should include all crimes. And one of the ways people say to me, you're a terrorism expert. Why are you running for governor? I say, actually, I deal with risk and threats, whatever they are, whether it's climate change or crime on the streets or a Columbine or terrorism, as we saw. So our response to it should always be the same, right? Support for law enforcement and response and emergency management. It should be support for the communities. But Boston Marathon was different, and I won't deny it. I mean, it was a different kind of attack. It was an attack on the city and the state as a whole. And so I can understand both a focus on it and to support the victims. But I would never argue that it's more important than the bigger issues that are confronting our society, which are far beyond crime even.
The current governor,
yes,
and you'd like to be the future one, spends an hour a month with us in
studio. Why don't you sign her up now?
She wins. Exactly. I'm no Charlie Baker, but I'll do it.
I asked him, I guess about a month or so ago, based on the latest that you've heard from Bill Keating, who traveled to Russia, based upon what Police Commissioner Ed Davis said about communication in this Joint Terrorism Task Force, do you at least entertain the possibility that had the feds done their job, that the marathon horror could have been avoided? It's his most recent answer was no. Do you entertain?
Keating or
no, Deval Patrick.
I do not go down the path of the blinding clarity of hindsight. I mean, in hindsight, yes, we could put the pieces together and say, if only. But that's just not who I am. I mean, I think we learn from what happened. I think there should be an investigation, a separate investigation. But to say that each piece, if only someone had been smarter, we would have stopped that, it's really hard. I have a piece up that I wrote last year at the anniversary of 9/11 on my Twitter feed. You know, what we're dealing with now is a little bit like whack-a-mole. And we have so many threats right now. It's not just terrorism. And we have to accept as a society bad things will happen, whether it's climate, whether it's bad schools, whether it's an economy or an economic breakdown. How we should be judged as a society is how prepared we are for those moments. And that's what I bring to the table, right? That's the kind of management and leadership that I bring to the table, so that at any moment when that bad thing happens, you know how to work state government, federal government, get people together across the aisle, across all certain all types of stakeholders, and get to a solution. And that's so the blinding clarity of hindsight is a word we use, and I don't know, and that's why I've been asking for an investigation.
Well, speaking of investigation, let me seize on that word for a second. The Civil Liberties Unions of Massachusetts and Florida asked the attorneys general of those states, after the killing of a man who allegedly was involved in the triple murder also on 9/11 in Waltham, asked Martha Coakley specifically, who may be an opponent of yours, we don't know, for the Democratic nomination, to investigate the killing of this guy Todashev in his apartment in Orlando. Their contention being, one, that the FBI is not doing it. Two, the FBI, according to the Times, has cleared itself 150 out of 150 times when there's been a shooting, whether it led to death or not. Martha Coakley said she would not do it. Was she wrong?
Oh, I don't know the specifics. I'm very careful about ongoing investigations because we don't know the specifics, but certainly, at least what I've seen publicly as a public citizen, I don't think we have good enough explanations right now.
So would you ask the Attorney General if you were governor now to investigate? We had two state troopers there.
Right. And we had two state troopers there. And I mean, I'm a big fan of lessons learned. I mean, I'm a opposition researcher's dream. I mean, I was writing for the Boston Globe for almost 2 years. I was pushing for lessons learned, a review, an assessment. If it gets to blame an investigation, so be it. But, I mean, just think of all the things we go through and what we can learn from. I mean, the capacity of government to learn after something happens should never be denied. And I always say this about the Boston Marathon. We can talk about luck and Boston Strong, and I have a mantra that I don't actually do luck, because it wasn't luck. It was an investment in learning from past attacks, past crime, past whatever it is, to get better at what we do. And that's what I bring to – we can get better. And there's no finish line. I mean, government can always get better. There's no perfect situation. We just adapt and respond and get people to engage in the progressive politics and the public policy problems that we have.
So I guess you got carbon monoxide detectors in your house and all the smoke alarms are working all the time.
Absolutely. What kind of I'm a mother first, actually, so I hope every mother and father have it.
Well, that's one of the things I want to ask you about. I mean, you had the gig at the Globe, working there 2 years, writing a column. You're on CNN all the time.
Right.
You had the Homeland Security thing. You're teaching at Harvard. I mean, you got a great deal going.
I did.
Plus, you got the three kids as well, and they're pretty young. Why do you want to do this? I mean, you got to go from Yarmouth to Pittsfield, then to Lawrence, and down to back. I mean,
my kids are a pain. No, I'm joking.
Get away from the kids. That's a good reason.
No, there. Look, I have served most of my life in the public sector. I love working in government. I've worked in state government and federal government. I have the skills. I have the, you know, sort of varied and diverse background that I think will help, or that I know will help, for the challenges of the future. So that's the why. And I also think there's not much disagreement about what the priority should be, right? Jobs, education, technology, climate change, all those big issues. It's the how. And I think, just given my experience that I want to provide to everyone who will listen to me at every caucus and every district, an opportunity to hear what I've done, both as a civil rights litigator, as well as someone — that's how I started my career — as well as someone in Homeland Security and crisis management. I love this state. I have to say, I've had many jobs in government. State government federal government's really exciting because, you know, you have these big things. State government is the most fulfilling job I've ever had, period.
Really?
Absolutely. You can have ideas. They can get done. It's a manageable. But plus, what it means to be in Massachusetts. I have traveled to, I think we were figuring out, 43 or 44 other states. We're really good. We're not perfect. But to the extent that that government accepts new ideas, can change and modify, that we are a beacon of rights for gay marriage and immigration and new energy sources. All of these issues make it very exciting and also doable. And that was really, as people talk to me, as I talk to people about this possibility, that's what I wanted to bring to the table.
Well, give us the Cliff Notes version on what you do about education, because that's a big issue. A lot of people think the public schools are failing horribly in the big cities, and they're not doing so great in the suburbs either. What would you do?
Right. So if it's K through 12, I mean, right, so I would have a evidentiary-based approach to it. So we know two things for sure work in schools, right? Better student-teacher ratios and training education technology for teachers. Those are the two things. You just look at any of the evidence out there, and that's it. So you invest in those two aspects, and you see and you help the schools sort of deliver. So that's number one. You give alternatives. I know it's a huge debate about charter schools here. Right now, there's no other alternatives for people who want to stay in the system, right? And I think as a parent who has two children in public school and one in private, for a very personal decision that we made about my daughter, how would I stand here and say there can be no choice, right? That seems to me to be the height of hypocrisy. Higher education is different because we know the jobs that people should be getting educated for, right? Biotech, tech, health, the health industry, education. And we're going to have a gap, right? And unless we address that gap, which is addressable, right? You steer students towards those majors. You support teachers in those efforts. We won't be educating the students that are going to stay in Massachusetts. The great thing about our public education system, our students stay here.
Yeah.
Right? We invest in them. They stay here. Let's get focus on the jobs that will have them stay there. Give them the education that will get them those jobs.
She is Juliette Kayyem. She's running for the Democratic nomination because she can't stand her children. She's had a couple.
People ask me a lot about how to do this with the kids. I've worked all my life, and my, you know, what I say to all mothers is, they don't, and fathers, they don't have an alternative mother, right? And I, all that matters is that I love them the most, right? And they know it. And like most working mothers, we, and stay-at-home mothers, like, you know, you make it work.
And you have a husband that helps you, I would imagine.
Of course. And he's listening, and he's wondering why I didn't mention him until 8 minutes into
the... Marjorie mentioned him, actually. You didn't mention it at all. Julia Kayyem, you mentioned, you've used the word invest a lot. You talked about education. Deval Patrick proposed a $2 billion tax increase, half of it to go to education, half of it to go to transportation. He got not a nickel. Well, he got some through the budget. He didn't get much on the education front. He got $500 million on, give or take a few bucks, on transportation, some of which, this software tax, may be repealed. I know you support the repeal. Did you, with the exception of the software thing, did you support the $2 billion tax package that he was advocating?
So, let me talk about the governor's plan and sort of, I supported what the taxes would go to.
Understood.
I think it is important to invest in those two areas. I talk about them all the time as well. You can't imagine us successful in the 21st century without a greater focus on education and infrastructure. On the tech tax, if I could just answer that directly, I think, like most people who have seen it, that there's been enough hoopla about it that we should maybe revisit a tech tax. Mm-hmm. But I want to make clear, this is a mature industry that has lobbyists and others who can debate with legislators. So to stand here and say, I'm never going to have a tech tax is ridiculous, right? You don't know what the industry is going to look like in the future.
Well, put that aside for a second. How about the other $1.8 billion
support? I think my first job as governor will be to do a budget review to see where you can get the savings, where you can get creative forms of income, right? Is it a private infrastructure bank which I'm promoting? Is it other forms of taxes like more penalty taxes or, you know, cigarette, alcohol, whatever else? And then decide where you want to ask for more taxes. But I want to say something about what just happened with the legislature. A governor should push, right? It is not a failure any governor should not start on what's going to be acceptable to the legislature, right? You start by the push. And we may disagree on the margins of where this governor or another governor pushes the envelope. But I have to tell you, you know, that's part of the democratic process. And you want someone in that role who's not going to settle. Right. And whether it's on progressive policies or and criminal justice reform or whether it's on new forms of income or new taxes.
But just so I'm clear on that part, we understand you supported the goals of the spending on the way he would raise money. You were supportive with the exception of the
Fed. And I was. And I think I have to be honest. I think that we're going to have it will be revisited by the next governor because the investments in pre-K and education have to be funded somehow. So we have the casinos, right? So that's and that's why people say, "Oh, you support casinos." I support the revenue that the casinos are going to bring because they go to. You look at that number. How will we fund public education without casinos? So people who are for the repeal, you have to say, where are we going to get that income generation for? So that's how I think about it. I've taken over a lot of offices. First thing you do, right? Who are the people? What's the budget look like? And so that is what it is. And so the governor, knowing what he knows, right, went for a big ask, right? And I do not criticize anyone for the big ask because you know through the the legislative process it's going to come back, right? It's going to compromise, and that's right.
Julia, what's your website?
Oh, thank you. www.julietkayem, and I'll spell it KAYYEM.com. I am not related to Omar or Victor. It's a different.
That was our next question.
Apparently, that's a rumor in the State House. It
we
is not true.
We hope to see a lot in the months ahead.
Julia,
I
hope so too.
Time.
It's really great, and thank you for having me.
Oh, you're
welcome.
Julia Kimes running for governor of the Democratic ticket. Former columnist for the Globe, lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Spent nearly 15 years in counterterrorism and homeland security. Next week, tune in at this time to hear from another gubernatorial candidate, Don Berwick. When we come back, Chuck Todd from NBC News on Syria, Obama, John Kerry. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH.
Next time on The World, what's a president to do?
Syria is an enormous test case for what the U.S. can and needs to do in the 21st century to stop these egregious crimes against civilians.
People now preparing for war, and they are expecting a Western intervention here.
In advance of President Obama's address to the nation, we ask what's at stake in Syria on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Celebrity Series of Boston, celebrating its 75th season of presenting great artists in classical music, jazz, dance, spoken word, and more. Tickets to more than 70 performances are on sale now. More at celebrityseries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Could this apparent off-the-cuff remark from John Kerry at a press conference in the UK yesterday be the path to a non-military solution to the Syria crisis?
Is there anything at this point that his government could do or offer that would stop an attack?
Sure. He could turn over every single bit of his chemical weapons to the international community in the next week. Turn it over. All of it, without delay, and allow a full and total accounting for that. But he isn't about to do it, and it can't be done, obviously.
Here with us to discuss the president's speech tonight and the road ahead is Chuck Todd. He's the chief White House correspondent for NBC News. He's the political director of NBC News, and he's the host of the Daily Rundown, which, Chuck, it's great to see you.
Nice to see you.
So, Chuck Todd, I mean, our own former senator here, John Kerry, could possibly be the accidental hero here. But I'm nervous that we can trust this proposal with the Russians and Assad.
I think there's no doubt we're in a delay, not than anything else. But I want to just pause there for a minute because you two appreciate this. So Ryan Liz, a great reporter at The New Yorker, he tweeted the following. He tweeted a following a phony conversation between Joe Biden and John Kerry, and he said, and they're comparing whose gaffes were more effective. And Joe Biden says, well, my gaffe caused him to support gay marriage. And John Kerry goes, oh, yeah, my gaffe stopped the war.
That is great.
One of the more amusing tweets today. But I think that what you're going to see and what we're already seeing is that there's going to be some form of an authorization that accounts for this Russian thing, that gives 45 to 60 days, that allows members of Congress to feel comfortable that there is a real ultimatum here, that they've drawn a real line in the sand, that they've given Assad every moment to comply in some form. And then it makes their vote a little bit easier, giving the president authorization. I'll be curious to see, will he get an – what John McCain and Chuck Schumer are trying to include is an putting in all this Russian plan, but then still having an authorization in there if Syria does not comply, whether that can pass itself. I think it can. It's easier than what they were trying to do before, but it still won't be easy.
I'm assuming part of what the president's going to say tonight, Chuck Todd, is were it not for the threat of a military strike, Russia wouldn't have done what they did in response to Secretary of State Kerry, and Syria surely would not have agreed to. Is that past the laugh test?
Well, I think he's going to – they're going to make these claims. And you know what? Yes, it should pass the laugh test. I mean, at the end of the day, we were at the brink. And yes, we're watching all the American politicians do what they normally have never done, embrace an international idea, right? Oh, my God, Putin's got an idea. Let's take the Putin idea. And you're like, really?
That's a great point.
I mean, it is sort of striking, but it tells you they all read their own polling, right? They're desperate for a way out. They were looking for a solution. So when you say, but, you know, at the end of the day, Putin did arguably – certainly Assad. Now, we have to ask, what is Assad's motivation for doing this? What were we going to do with our military strike? Well, we were going to essentially decapitate him militarily, make it so he was no longer going to be as effective of a fighting force against these Syrian rebels. Assad didn't want that. That was going to change the balance of power, so did the Russians. So there was an incentive for the Russians to come through, for them to come through on this, and that's why they've done it. And which does need to remind us, there is one set of losers in all this.
What? Which is that?
The Syrian rebels. The Syrian rebels are waking up this morning thinking, great, the cavalry's not coming. We thought no matter what that the U.S. was going to do, just something, even if it was minimal, the U.S.'s version of minimal would have still degraded Assad in a way that would have tipped the balance of power.
So what does this mean to our international reputation as the one great exceptional country that can come in and be the cavalry in these situations?
Well, if not us, who? It's not like we're being replaced by somebody else.
Right.
What to me has been amazing about this whole exercise is how it's basically us and France that has been willing to do anything. And after that, the rest of the world wants to put their hands on their collective ears and put their hands over their eyes and not get involved and let all these regional conflicts play each other out. So I don't – everybody says, well, this has hurt us on the international stage. But who replaces us? You know, we're all degrading together.
Well, that's what you wanted. Do we want to, in some ways, not be hurt, but to step back from being the international policeman because it's costing us a lot, needless to say.
Right.
Is that a good thing long term for us or not?
You want somebody else to be it?
Well, you know what's amazing? It's funny
no,
to say that.
That's the
no.
thing. And that's part of – you asked what the president's going to talk about tonight. One of the things – and I thought it was the most effective thing he said in Russia when he was trying – I consider myself just an average citizen. I'm trying to understand the case. I understand the idea of holding him accountable. I don't understand what things would look like on day four of the military strikes. How do you justify we're going to kill innocent people? How does that look? How does that judge? What's it going to look like? And I thought, though, that where he was starting to have some traction, and I would hear from family members saying, well, that's an interesting case, is when he said, you know what, America, we're stuck. We are the world superpower. We have no choice but to be the police officer sometimes. Nobody else will do it. And if that's the case, what else do we – if not us, there's nobody else that will do things like this, hold people accountable, not stop people of gassing children. So I think when you say what else is he going to say, he's still going to press his case for why this is still – because the argument's going to be if I don't – if the White House wants to claim that the pressure is – working, and that's what came Russia to the table, then you can't stop the pressure.
You were saying that you thought this whole war weariness was a function of Colin Powell and the Security
Council. It's a
wreck.
There's
thing.
No doubt it's
it
a
is
wreck.
A wreck. Yeah. Well, the American people, you know, one of the things I find really weird is that it seems to me that their distaste for this, and the latest poll I've seen is the New York Times poll this morning, 2-1 against this thing, is their distaste for it is going to grow because of this carrot that's being held out here, that there may be a solution. And that same poll, 70-some percent say we should consult the UN. We're all bred in the last decade to have utter contempt for the UN. We're supposed to sort of cowboy-like go it alone. So doesn't this weaken his case, not strengthen his case, because there may be a deal in the works?
Well, I think it weakens his case tonight. It could strengthen his case with Congress, right? Ultimately, he wants the authorization.
Right.
Okay? And, you know, I was talking to one of his really close aides, and I said, why? He didn't need the authorization for this. And he said, but what the president felt, because, A, number one, he didn't have any international support, so he felt like he needed some legitimacy somewhere. And, you know, the UN was a non-starter. The Arab League wasn't working. The best shot he had was Congress. But the second thing supposedly the president was thinking about is, I'm going to be asking for – I'm going to have to go to Congress for Iran. If Iran does cross, there is no doubt, because that's going to be a heavier burden on the military, a heavier burden on a bigger threat and all that stuff. So he felt that he had to test this proposition now. I think that they've learned – I assume they've learned some lessons on how to go about this if he has to do this in, say, 18 months.
We're talking with Chuck Todd from MSNBC. He's the chief White House correspondent for MSNBC. You've seen him in a million places.
And NBC.
And
I straddle both fences of the multiple platforms of the – NBC News Group, as
and
we like to
we've
call
all
it.
Seen him in the press conference. We've also seen you. I loved your little number numerical stuff during the election. You were absolutely terrific
well,
at that.
We're going to keep doing it.
Now, you didn't call it the wall. That was John King from CNN. What was your deal with the numbers? There was
We just were using a touchscreen. We were just we didn't have a good name for it. I guess we need to come up with a better name.
Well, you were great. You were great with the numbers.
Yeah. But we were just simply accurate.
Okay,
that's what I always like to say.
There has been obviously much talk about what this whole thing would mean to Obama's the rest of his presidency. So if he can extricate himself from this disaster and not have a military strike, which is still very unpopular with the American public, that, I assume, is a good thing for the rest of his term.
Well, it means it's not a disaster. I mean,
you think it would have been a disaster?
I do think he would have had a full-fledged political crisis on his hands.
Okay.
I mean, is it as, you know...
Why? Because you think they would have voted down Congress, one of the branches, would have voted down a straight military strike?
I mean, I think if the vote had ever gone through and it went down, that yes, it sort of weakens him. It gives him the stench of defeat. There is this sense of, and you know the way Washington politicians act, right? They don't walk away from politicians that look like they're, you know, it's like it would have been, we suddenly would be having August 2005 flashbacks, right? When Katrina hit and Iraq, all of a sudden people just fled Bush, right? Everybody was fleeing Bush. You'd have Democrats fleeing him at a time when he can't afford it, right? He's in the middle of negotiations on the budget. He's got health care. He's got to implement all this. So this salvages him, buys him more time on this. But, you know, he's still in a – it's funny. He has ever since – and this all to me, NSA is his – is sort of was the breaking point. The NSA leak story eroded support among his base for the first time, and he's not gotten it back. And this has hurt him now as he's trying to win support for Syria. It's going to hurt him in the fall. He does – he still needs to recover from that, which has been a pretty debilitating – hit as one former aide said, he goes, that was a hit to the main engine, right? Because this was credit. This was the guy who wasn't going to be using the super secret government, who wasn't going to be like Bush, and it felt like a Bush era tactic. This leaking and listening in and NSA secrets and all of this stuff. And every time, it seems as if the White House kept changing its story because new information would come out.
Does he really? Let's step back just for a couple of seconds. Did he want this? I mean, I'm of the school that he basically painted himself in a box. I'm of the red line argument that he couldn't figure a way out of this thing. Because
he never said you buy the argument that if he'd never said red line, we wouldn't be having
this. Yes,
exactly.
The
reality
is
he was the president who was going to get us out of the Middle East, not get us more involved in the Middle East. Right. You know, he announces with great fanfare, as he should, the end of combat forces in Iraq, then Afghanistan, that sort of thing. Is this what he wanted? I mean, he and Kerry have made a fairly compelling case, I think less so than maybe others. But did he really want this thing, or he got trapped?
I think he felt obligated. I think if you follow him closely, and you especially the people that he listens to the most on foreign policy.
Who is that, by the way?
Susan Rice and Samantha Power. It always has been. The two of them. And they're the old – you know, don't forget, Kennedy liberals were interventionists. right? You had the Kennedy, the old John Kennedy interventionist, you know, it was a believer. And the Democratic Party for years was the party of, and then, of course, Vietnam sort of, you know, threw up the, and then suddenly the Democrats became an anti-war party. You know, they weren't, and it, people forget this, they weren't necessarily an anti-war party before.
You were stopping communists.
Vietnam. Right. They were in some ways stronger on it than Republicans were in some arguments. And I think Obama, particularly Susan Rice and Samantha Power, but the president subscribed to this too, he is an interventionist. He is a stability guy. He's a Bush 41 guy when it comes to the geopolitical world. You know, don't promote democracy. You might elect Hamas, but you need to promote stability. But you want to be, you know, you want to be transparent about it. So it was sort of a mix, you know, more like Bush 41 clearly than 43. But I think he always, I think that, you know, because he kept coming back to it, gassing of children, the gassing of children, and he would bring up Rwanda. I think ultimately his instinct is to be an interventionist during a humanitarian crisis.
So, Chuck Todd, let's step back here for a second. We're always watching these presidential press conferences. We'll get back to Syria in a second. When you're sitting in that room and you're waiting for the leader of the free world to say, Chuck Todd, NBC News, what's going through? You have a big smile on your face. What's going through your head? I mean, when that's happening.
Well, first of all, you know, you have six or seven questions ready. And I always believe a press conference is, you know, we're not – it's not about the individual reporter asking questions. We are working – we should – if done right, we're working together, right? We're one giant reporter. We know what the news of the day is, and we need to – you know, so if you're first, whoever's – you're obligated for the rest of – ask the obvious question first. Don't just do your story. Don't be selfish about it. So there is that aspect, right? You have to read
the
room.
Sorry, not to be selfish.
No, it is. And you know, if you notice, for the most part, I feel like we're all pretty good about that. We're, you know, all right, well, that topic's exhausted. Just because I didn't like the way my colleague from ABC asked a question, I'm not going to re-ask it. That's wasting the viewer's time. Let's move on to a new topic. So you do have that. So I'm always anxious, like, please ask me first, second, or third, because I'm always really happy with my first couple of questions. You know, if you're stuck with question five or six in your rundown of questions, then you're like, oh, man, you know, you're just kind of bummed.
So you're anxious waiting for the name
always
to be
a little. You're always a little anxious. It's still, you know,
suppose everybody else takes your questions and you have none left.
Right. Well, that's the idea,
right?
That's why you're like, you're doing your,
exactly.
Like, you know, sometimes there's a great story. I think it's Phil Jones. Phil Jones was a reporter for CBS, White House reporter. And apparently Bob Schieffer tells this story. He said one time Phil Jones was just, you know, presidential conference with Carter administration, and he just blanked. Carter calls on him.
Oh, God.
And he blanked, and he just finally just blurted out, "What about the Russians?" Well, you know, this is 79. This is Cold War. That can mean anything.
That's
no
great.
One noticed. Carter made the most news of that press conference answering that question because – Carter didn't even know what the hell the question was about, but he clearly had something that he wanted to say about the Russians.
Now, I want to ask you, I just asked you before if you read Mark Leibovich's book, This Town, which is, if people don't know it, we had him on the show a couple of weeks ago. It's an indictment, basically, of the press.
He's a big Bostonian. He loves your Red
Sox. He's a big Bostonian. He used to work for the Boston Phoenix, but it's an indictment of the Washington Press Corps in many senses.
It's an indictment of Politico. I really think more so than if you want to know whether he meant it that way or not, I feel like it's the culture of Politico, BuzzFeed, and the new media.
That's true.
In general.
But he's also talking about the corrosiveness of money, which is nothing new, except that he said it's accelerated now. What you have is a lot of people say, Chuck Todd, not that this would happen to you, but if some lobbyist said, Chuck, you know, I think you're doing great work. I could give you a great job at X lobbying firm. That what happens is a lot of the people that are still in power, even either in the government or in the media, start doing the bidding of these lobbyists while they're still working for the government or the media. It was a very depressing book, in the sense that Washington is totally out of touch with the rest of the country. What do
you
think?
Well, I think that I would argue every state capital in America has a version of this, right? There is sort of a political – if Eisenhower warned us about a military-industrial complex, every robust state capitals and, of course, the nation's capital have a political-industrial complex. You guys see Boston. You know Beacon Hill. How much of a revolving door is it? The name of the governor may change, the party affiliate, but if the party – you know who the crew of people that are Republicans that will work in a Republican administration, and you know the same crew of people that are going to work in a Democratic administration. Happens in Beacon Hill, happens in Columbus, Ohio, happens in Washington, D.C. So that's one part. But I do think this acceleration of lobbying and the amount of money that's put into there is – there is so – look, we were recession-proof. okay? During
exactly.
the all right, I, you know,
party.
In Northern, I let's look at Northern Virginia. You know, remember, you know, everybody said, "Boy, the economy is doing great in Northern Virginia." Now, part of that is defense contracts. What are those? Government contracts. What do you have there? A whole bunch of lobbyists trying to keep those government contracts. So, I think that that creates the bubble that people, and it warps salary structures. So, let's say you're a member of Congress. And you see some idiot staffer of yours making seven times what you make as a member of Congress.
Ooh.
And then you sit there and say, what am I doing this for? So why doesn't that member of Congress say, you know what, I'm out of here? And it becomes a, you know, I'm going to go get mine. I've worked hard. Why shouldn't I get mine? Perfectly rational human reaction. But then it's created this mess that Mark did a good job of sort of laying out. It is frustrating. But I do think it's this whole lobbying, you know, thing that is, and by the way, that sustains the size of government.
Let's end where we began, Chuck Todd. Play Nostradamus for a second. How's this play out?
I think we do get this 45-60-day thing. I think the president gets a conditional authorization from members of Congress that says, if this doesn't happen, and if this doesn't happen type of thing, probably three ifs, the ifs of some form of the United Nations, the security of this. Maybe if there's any evidence that he ever uses it again, you've got, you know, carte blanche. But it will be conditional, probably 60, 90 days type of thing. And it'll expire, meaning he'll have to come – if he hasn't used it, he has to come back and get it again.
Chuck Todd, thanks. I'm already in Chuck Todd withdrawal, frankly, after the last 18 hours. Hey, Chuck, it was great to see you. Right, thanks so much for your time.
Okay, what's the name of the show? It's on every morning from 9 to 10.
It's The Daily Rundown.
The Daily Rundown. And I'm going to get it right this time. Chuck Todd is Chief White House Correspondent for NBC News, as well as the Political Director of NBC. Thank you so much for being with us, Todd. Appreciate it much. And great show every morning at 9 o'clock.
Well, you're kind to say that.
When we come back, we're going to take a break from Syria. I know you need one. I certainly need one. We're going to do something completely different. It's going to be music to your ears, literally. Our concert roundtable is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This week on Greater Boston, meet the candidates running for mayor of Boston. I'm Emily Rooney. Hear three candidates a night over four nights as they discuss pressing issues facing the city. Join us for these unique discussions with the candidates for mayor tonight at 7 on Greater Boston on WGBH2 and right here on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Northeastern University, where researchers are creating interactive tools from apps to avatars to help us make healthier choices. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow. And Mass Mocha, presenting Fresh Grass, a three-day festival of bluegrass and roots music, September 20th through the 22nd, featuring Del McCoury, Leftover Salmon, The Devil Makes Three, and more. Info at freshgrass.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And we're taking a break from Syria, as Marjorie said, and plunging into the undeniable power and joy of music. It's time for our concert roundtable, which we're going to try to do every 6 weeks. Here with us in studio three are Rob Hochschild. He's with Berklee College of Music. Hello there, Rob.
Hello.
Brian, hello to you. Brian McCreath is host with 99.5 WCRB and producer for the Boston Symphony Orchestra radio broadcast. Hello there, Brian.
Hi there.
Edgar B. Herrick III is with GBH's Curiosity Desk. Hello to you, Edgar.
Ahoy, ahoy.
Whatever. Rob is doing jazz. Brian is doing classical. And Edgar will be doing, let's say, rock and alternative music.
All others.
That's right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We're
going to do a little round table here. We're going to start with Rob because he is, after all, the guest. So tell us what you got for us, Rob.
Well, thank you so much for
having me,
everybody. Well, we're going to talk about one of the biggest free outdoor concerts of the year. First, it's the Berklee Beantown Jazz Festival, September 28th. Slew of artists, three stages on Columbus Ave between Mass Ave and Burke Street. The theme is Jazz, the Next Generation. A lot of young artists on this bill. Also, some crossover artists like Michelle Ndege Ocello is actually playing in this show. Her last record was a tribute to Nina Simone. But the artists we're going to listen to today is Christian Scott. He's a trumpeter from New Orleans. He's one of these very ambitious, fascinating, brilliant young band leaders, just bursting with ideas, 30 years old. And he's been influenced by a whole range of music, hip hop and rock and all kinds of stuff. He's covered Radiohead, very well-read guy. Anyway, this album is a sprawling double disc. It's sort of a tribute to New Orleans. There's a lot of political commentary that manifests through instrumental tunes. But the one we're going to hear is sort of a more lighter piece. This is one that's a tribute to his mother. It's called Kara. This is Christian Scott with Lawrence Fields on piano.
That is totally beautiful. That is totally beautiful. And by the way, when you mentioned his name, both Edgar and Brian were given a thumbs up, head nodding kind of response.
Yeah, he's great.
So he goes, obviously, he goes beyond just the jazz community.
Oh, yeah, and he's, I'm glad to hear that. And he's established his name over the last few years. He's got 8 albums out as a leader, and this is a really beautiful sound. If it sounds a little bit like Miles Davis, it's because he's using a Harmon mute on his trumpet and just kind of has that almost modal, quiet chordal background. So really beautiful player with a lot of high energy music.
New Orleans just remains this fascination, right? Like people come out of New Orleans that are just ridiculous, and it's just wonderful that in this age when everything, all places seem to be like looking the same and acting the same, and culture is just flattening out, New Orleans remains this place where someone like Christian Scott grows up and is just like drenched in jazz and music and everything about it that's so exciting.
The
right?
music is still very alive there.
It's totally alive.
Yeah. Jazz on the streets, in the bars, throughout New Orleans. It's there.
Right. Okay, so that was Brian and Edgar. Brian.
Hey, Jim.
Brian McCreese.
Jim.
Give us a little classical touch here, if you can.
Okay, we're going to start with the 900-pound gorilla of the music scene, and it's the BSO. It's a big season because they now have announced their new music director. We've talked about this on the air here before. And he'll be along. Andres Nelsons will be along in October. And yet, for all the great, exciting things the BSO is doing this season, actually, I'm going to focus on something that's coming up in the second week of the season. Season opens on September 21st. The following week, it's a chance to hear a life-changing piece of music. That's right, Mahler's Second Symphony.
I knew you were going to say Mahler. Every time you say life-changing, you say Mahler within 30 seconds.
Right.
Every
Edgar
time.
Knows this. I keep trying to say to Edgar, you've got to go to this Mahler concert because it will change your life. You will leave the hall a different person from the person you walked in as.
Yeah.
And what's great about this is that it's not just another performance of Mahler's Second as if they're like, you know, growing on trees. They're not. But still, Christoph von Dohnányi is leading this. And Christoph von Dohnányi is a person who is one of the elder statesmen. He just there's nobody who is more grounded in the cultural origins of Mahler's symphonies than is Dohnányi.
So we're going to hear this.
We're going to hear a little bit of this now.
I'm dying now. Yeah. I need a life-changing experience.
We're going to start here in the last movement of this huge, long piece. The entire piece is just the length of a concert, right? So here is some of the last movement with the Tanglewood Festival Chorus and the BSO. Getting higher and higher. We're just ascending. The choir is taking us up.
To where our lives change.
Our lives are changing as we hear this.
Boy, that's beautiful, too.
Now, imagine we're hearing this on the radio, and it's beautiful. But now think about this in Symphony Hall with 300 people in the choir on the stage, another 100 in the orchestra, and the room is just filled with this sound. There's just no other experience
it's
like
beautiful.
It.
Beautiful.
Serious goosebumps.
It's just
it's huge.
Edgar, the bar is
hold
really...
On, hold on. How much are the cheap seats at the BSO?
I don't even know.
Cheap seats. I wondered.
I'll lend you a few bucks.
I want a Frankly,
Marjorie,
well.
I'm down in the control room for this. And so I've got a seat that's in the basement
myself.
We can
look it up online.
But please do. I think that you'll really, really love this particular piece. And then the entire BSO season is spectacular.
Can you match these boys, Edgar?
Absolutely not. I got the pop music. and now some inconsequential pop music. No, seriously, the first one I want to talk about, we're going to also stay outdoors. The summer is not quite over, so there's still a couple of outdoor festivals going on, including one this weekend up in Burlington, Vermont. This is the Grand Point North Festival. Now, we don't have a lot of time. I'm not going to play music from two of these artists, but Jim, you have 10 seconds. I'm going to tell you one of the people on the bill. You have 10 seconds to tell us why you are in love with this person. Grace Potter is playing both nights.
Because this woman can really sing, I'll tell you. And also, when you watch, I've never seen her live, only seen her in video. We almost had her on last week. We had a little bit of a screw up here. She feels her songs. Is that a fair way? Do you feel the same way?
I totally agree with that.
And by the way, she's a Burlington native.
Yeah.
And a reporter at NECN, Jack Thurston, tells me he used to go to her concerts not so long ago where it'd be him and one or two other people in the coffee house and nobody else watching.
I mean, she hasn't been around for all that long. So she's the headliner both nights. And then on the Sunday day, there's somebody that I know Brian McCreath likes, a guy named Trombone Shorty. I'll give you 15 seconds. Tell us why Trombone Shorty is the man.
I'm telling you, Trombone Shorty is a musical genius. And I've been listening to his recent album. Literally, it's out today. This is the release date for his new album. And this guy he's one of these people, like Christian Scott, comes out of New Orleans, steeped in the New Orleans jazz tradition. He does everything. You look at this album, what's funny is every track, it's like the credits, vocals, Trombone Shorty. Horns, Trombone Shorty.
Arrangement.
Produced by Trombone Shorty. Yeah. I mean, he just does it all. And it is the most genre-crossing, most energetic, fresh sound that I've heard in years.
Yeah, energetic's definitely right. Yeah. I saw him live 2 years ago at Newport Jazz, and he just blew everybody away. So that said, I'm going to play one of the people who are down the bill. So at this festival, we got Grace Potter, we've got Trombone Shorty, we've got Charles Bradley, who we've also heard here before. But down the bill is a band called Shovels and Rope. This is a married couple. They're from South Carolina, kind of along with a larger wave of people kind of playing country music, but maybe not country music like you're hearing on the radio, something a little bit different. Let's hear a little bit of Shovels and Rope.
Between the veil of darkness and light, the sweet and sorrowful hour that separates morning and night. I roll you in the flower.
Yeah, I feel like a moron. That's great too. Just every single one of these where are they from again?
They're from South Carolina. That's where, and they're a married couple. They're terrific, and you got two chances to see them. They're at this festival on Sunday, but they're also going to be playing the Royale right here in town on Saturday night. So Saturday or Sunday, you can see Shovels and Ropes.
You know, by the way, if those of you are driving around getting nervous because you can't scribble all this thing down, every single one of these concerts and who's playing will be on our website at WGBHnews.org shortly after the show. Okay, Rob, round two.
Alrighty, well, that was a great vocalist, and now we're about to hear another one. This is Aubrey Logan, who is a very young jazz artist playing at Scullers on September 18th, and she's somebody who I'm pretty sure none of you guys have heard of, but she's going to be somebody who we're all going to be familiar with as time goes on. She's very much steeped in the tradition of jazz, like Christian Scott, and influenced by other contemporary styles, pop and R&B and funk, and she has an EP out. She is sort of following in the footsteps of artists in a way like Esperanza Spalding and Norah Jones, great instrumentalists who are also great vocalists and songwriters. Aubrey Logan plays trombone. Not quite like Trombone Shorty, but you're going to like what you hear here. This is High Place from Aubrey Logan.
The rusted rooms have rotted in the cold December snow.
Yeah.
And it would take eternity to scrub them all clean. And the only way down is to fall in your arms again. But then I wouldn't win. Let me talk about my high place. It's my place. You have
to. It was incredible. All this music, I've heard of none of it. I mean, I feel like it's an idiot.
That's why we're doing this, Margaret.
So she's glad
wonderful.
To help you.
Yeah, she's sure. Absolutely wonderful.
And here she is playing trombone. So that's not something you hear every day. So
meaning women playing trombones. That
that's
what you're
right.
Pointing
yeah.
out?
But that's right.
You're Berkeley, though. Women in horns seem to be something that, has increased, which I think is a great thing. Is that am I wrong, or is that really
no,
like a movement?
I definitely think there's more of an upswing in that kind of thing. I also think that it's an age when the world is more open to women playing all kinds of instruments. When I first started working at Berklee 20 years ago, the jazz world was not as open to women playing instruments like brass instruments as they are now.
So she just finishes singing and then picks up the trombone right
It's amazing.
Stage.
What's awesome about that, though, I love that because what she does is she's singing in her soprano voice and it's beautiful and light and up there. And then because she plays, she gets into the tenor range.
Right.
She's like
taking
it down there, gets some thick sounds. And, you know, and I also love that this swings, but it doesn't sound like old time swing.
Right.
It's a fresh modern swing. There's some sort of cross rhythms that she does that's really, really kind of more in our time.
The aerobics
right?
there must
the
be
old
really
and the new.
Amazing.
Yeah. And she's got a range of styles on her YouTube page as well. If you want to see some fun videos of her doing that kind of singing trombone thing, check her out on YouTube as well. Good stuff.
Nice. Wow, another trombone.
Brian,
that's the one I didn't know about. Okay,
Brian
all right. So we're going to go with someone
5.
Else. Yeah, 99.5. So I don't really mean to be a one-trick pony here, but it seems like every time I talk to people about concerts, Bach comes up. So, but this time, Bach.
Good, but not life-changing. Is that where he is?
He's no Mahler.
No,
the most ultimate in life-changing. So there's this fellow named Chris Thiele. Chris Thiele is a mandolin player. He comes out of the bluegrass kind of scene, and yet, like these other guys that we're talking about, or women, he crosses over into these other genres. He pulls in influences from everywhere, and so that's why Chris Thiele ends up collaborating with Yo-Yo Ma in the Goat Rodeo sessions. That's why he's one of the members of the Punch Brothers. And when you hear Chris Thiele playing, you're not feeling like this is old-timey kind of bluegrass. This is like, whoa, there's something energetic and happening here. But his most recent disc, and that was something that he's going to be playing from on October 20th, presented by the Celebrity Series, is Bach. So what he did was he took the solo violin pieces, which are some of the most amazing pieces ever written for a single instrument, and he's playing them on mandolin. It's a very unexpected combination. Mm. And I think that when we hear this, we're going to hear a little bit of a beginning of a fugue. And so a fugue is one of these things where there's multiple lines, multiple melodies that intersect and create harmonies. And I think it's such a cool sound when you hear a mandolin doing this. And Chris Thiele, he's one of the few that probably could pull it off because his chops are just so ridiculous.
Yeah, he can play.
I mean, he can just play anything. Yeah. So let's hear a little bit of this opening fugue from the sonata in G minor here. Kind of feel like there's got to be more than one player involved here.
Well, you know what I was going to say, because Bach is something I do know something about. You cannot make a mistake in Bach. It is so difficult because there's no cover.
That's right.
There it might be in Mahler or one romantic composer. So that is incredible that
that's
he could
do
that.
And what's really funny is I actually had a chance to talk to him a few weeks ago at Tanglewood because he and Yo-Yo played at the Goat Rodeo sessions out there, and I had a chance to interview him real quick afterwards. He says that this is the music that actually prompted him to learn how to read music. He said several years ago he heard this music from Bach and he wanted to figure out. So he started playing it by ear because that's just what he does. He figures everything out by ear. He's got this ridiculous kind of inner ear. And he realized, wow, this is hard.
So my ear is not this good.
I was with my Mel Bay Learn to Read Music book trying to figure this out just so I could learn Bach. And now he's come up with this disc that's all Bach. And so when he plays on October 20th, he's going to play Bach, but then he'll also, because he is who he is, he's going to wrap in some of his own compositions and some other stuff from other people. It's going to be this this cross-genre thing that he does on October 20th.
Bach to Herwick.
We're going to get the only thing to do from here is to get weird.
Okay, please do it.
So let's get a little weird.
He's the man for the job.
So,
Eric the Third. Go
ahead. Marjorie, you mentioned that a lot of these artists you hadn't heard of. I suspect maybe you've heard of the band, maybe not, the Flaming Lips. Have you heard of those guys?
No, I have not heard of the
Say
Flaming
yes,
Lips.
Say yes, Ma. Yes, she has. Go ahead.
Whether you know it or not, you probably know them. Their music is used in car commercials and phone commercials and things like this. And they're sort of the modern keepers of the weird, psychedelic, electronic electronic folk strangeness that kind of existed and pervaded through the late 60s. But they've updated it for a modern era. They're from Oklahoma, of all places. And if you've never seen them live, even if you don't like their music, I would encourage you to go see them live. There are sock puppets. There is confetti. There is the lead singer, Wayne Coyne, will get in this huge clear bubble, like a giant beach ball. He'll get inside of it and roll himself out onto the crowd. All of this kind of insanity. It's
never
dramatic.
Seen Springsteen do sock puppets? No one does. No one does it quite like Springsteen.
Yeah, nobody does a sock puppet. So anyway, these guys are playing. It's worth seeing them because they're incredible. They put on a really strange and spectacular show, and their music is wonderful. But I'm going to play a cut from the opening act, who is a really good band from Down Under, from Australia. They're called Tame Impala. They're opening up for these guys. The concert is at Aganis Arena on the 30th of September, so it's coming up. So the Flaming Lips, who I think a lot of people have heard, and they're going to play along with a band called Tame Impala. Let's let them take us away a little bit.
Wow.
So you hear there, lead singer, who's a great singer. He sounds a little bit like John Lennon on a lot of his tracks. You can totally hear it. And that bass sound very much like Paul would play, that real high up on the neck. Boom, dee dee, boop, 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 boom. Really melodic.
I was going to say that, but I was afraid I was going to embarrass myself.
These guys are really good. They play everything from that kind of groovy stuff you hear there to some really hard driving rocking stuff. Then plus the insanity of the Flaming Lips is going to be a really fun show.
Sounds fabulous. Now, we're going to pick up the pace here because time is short and we want to cover as much as possible. The first round on jazz falls to you, Rob.
Francisco Mela and Cuban Safari. It's a good one to go quickly on because he plays a lot of high-energy music. A drummer from Bayamo, Cuba. He's played with greats like Joe Lovano and McCoy Tyner. He's got this sort of Miles Davis electric band influence. So this is high-energy jazz. This particular track also has haunting electric piano and soprano sax. This is Francisco Mela. Kind of a haunting electric piano thing.
Yeah.
Some multiphonics going on in
there. Yeah, there's some cool stuff happening here.
And I didn't mention where they were playing. It's Tufts University's Dissler Performance Hall on October 11th. That's open to the public and to Tufts students. So really interesting music coming from this guy.
Brian McCreath.
So it's the 40th anniversary season of Boston Baroque, the first full-time early music period instrument group in Boston. Boston's a center for early music, this meaning Baroque and Renaissance music. Martin Perlman has run this group for 40 years now. They've not only got a great season planned for early music, but they do a New Directions series. And so that's coming up on October 19th. We'll hear a little bit of Manuel de Falla's Concerto for Harpsichord, Flute, Oboe, Clarinet, Violin, and Cello right now. So the New Directions series is all about taking Baroque music and placing it in the context of newer music and music that combines these different eras. And Manuel de Falla wrote this in 1926, looking back to the Renaissance. And so this is just one part of this program that looks back and forward at the same time.
That was excellent.
That's Boston
excellent.
Baroque.
Okay, Edgar B. Herwirth III. I know you're feeling intimidated.
Being from a rural place myself, I have a soft spot for artists from faraway places or just places that are way off the beaten path. And this band, Youth Lagoon, is basically the moniker of a single guy who grew up in Idaho and did his very first record just alone in his bedroom in Idaho. This is his second record. His first record did really, really well. He's playing at the House of Blues on the 13th of October. A very unique sound. This is Youth Lagoon.
Why are you laughing, Rob? Why are you laughing at that particular moment there?
I just love the bounciness of that tune while we're thinking about You'll Never Die. You know, the sort of dark
dark and light is just perfectly mixed there.
That's awesome.
Do we have time to squeeze in one more Rob?
We actually,
jazz song
we
really
don't.
Quick?
But Rob, mention, we don't have time for more music, but is there another concert on your list quickly?
Yeah, Madeline Peyrou on October 27th at the Berklee Performance Center.
I love her.
She's doing some really cool stuff that's inspired by Ray Charles next month.
How about you, Brian?
Chameleon Arts Ensemble, one of the really great chamber music groups in Boston. They've won national awards for innovative programming. I urge everyone to check out Chameleon Arts Ensemble.
And Edgar, you finish it. What's missing?
Well, I'm a Philly guy. And the Life
hey,
is
so
Good.
Am I. Excuse
I know you
me.
Are.
And yeah, the, me too. How
and,
about that?
Whoa. And the Life Woo. Is Good Festival is going to have both The Roots and Hall & Oates playing.
Yes.
Oh, Hall & Oates. Yes. Oh.
So.
that was me, by Jim, the way. Jim Bradley. Thank you.
Jim, you make my dreams come true.
And you're whatever. You
That's
mind.
The end of September.
In any case, Hall & Oates. Ryan McCreath, Rob Hochschild, and Edgar B. Herwick III. Thanks. That was great. All Brian. Of this stuff is on WGBHnews.org.
And Brian's the host of 99.5 WCR. And a producer for the Boston Symphony Orchestra radio
great.
Broadcast. Rob Hochschild is with the Berklee School of Music, and Edgar B. Herwick III runs the WGBH Curiosity Desk. Thank you very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. We should say tonight, is it 8 or 9 that Obama's
9 speaking? O'clock live right here on GBH.
Yeah, it's going to be right here on WGBH, so listen to that. Tune in tomorrow. Brian McGroy, editor of the Boston Globe, is with us. Also, Andrew Basevich, a Boston University professor of history and international relations, will get his view on Obama and Syria. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Brody. Thanks for being here. See you tomorrow.
Bye.